drift across wax palms. The men all played along to marching drums, and boy did they have fun behind the scenes.
Welcome back to The Roundtable. Historian Lincoln Payne has just written a monumental retelling of world history through the lens of maritime enterprise, revealing in depth how people first came into contact with one another by ocean and river, lake and stream, and how goods, languages, religions, and entire cultures spread across and along the world's waterways, bringing together civilizations and defining what makes us most human. His amazing book is The Sea and Civilization, A Maritime History of the World, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Lincoln Payne to the program this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Give us a
very nice and generous introduction.
Well, I appreciate it. This is quite an accomplishment. How long has this been in the works?
Basically about 8 years, all told.
So what led you to the subject of wanting to think about it in these terms?
Well, I started out as a... I'd always been in history, and in 1997 I published an encyclopedia of historic ships. And that got me very interested in the basic idea that it was a story that we could frame in maritime terms that would tell the story of the sea, of the world, from a maritime perspective. The encyclopedia was a little incomplete, though, because it favored nations where there were records of ships with names. And so you therefore lose all of the Americas and Africa and lots of Asia before a certain date.
When you sit down to look at this last 3,500 years of civilization's history through the lens of maritime travel, did you know where you wanted to begin? I mean, because it seems that you can sort of start where you want, right?
Well, yes, you can always start pretty much where you want. The earliest evidence at the moment, it hasn't been corroborated, but there's suggestions that people were getting to the island of Crete in the Mediterranean 100,000 years ago. More concrete evidence exists that people first got to Australia by water 50,000 years ago. But then you've got sort of 45,000 years or so before things really kind of pick up. And so the baseline of 3,500 BC, the sort of start of the Egyptian civilization and the Sumerian civilizations, is a good one because then we have records of ships in pictures and models and stories. And so it's at that point where we can really begin to pick up the strands and start telling a story that has a little bit more vitality to it.
You make the point in the book that no one culture, race, or nationality, religion, or linguistic group has a monopoly on maritime endeavor. And just speak briefly about how this is so global and certainly not what many of us are taught, a Western specialty.
Well, exactly. It's not a Western specialty. And if you look at the roots, as I said, of the written record and the pictorial record, it really takes us right back to the civilizations of the Nile in Egypt and of the Tigris and the Euphrates and Mesopotamia in what's now Iraq and Iran. And the even before that, though, it's clear that there was a lot of maritime travel because you had people getting to places like Japan from the Asian mainland, and you had people spread all throughout Indonesia, again, from the Southeast Asian mainland. And there's even a hypothesis, quite strong, that people came from Asia to the Americas via a coastal maritime route 15,000 years ago or so. So the idea that maritime culture and maritime tradition is really a Western phenomenon is completely mistaken. And really the most fascinating bit about that is that we tend to think of the Vikings as being the sort of preeminent mariners, which in their time they absolutely were. But the Vikings, the Scandinavians, didn't have sails until about 200 years before the Viking raids began. They had rowed, and it's quite possible, in fact, that many of the migrants, the Anglos and the Saxons from Northwest Europe, rowed their boats to England as part of the Anglo-Saxon migrations. So other people, long before, had sails, and they were doing great things on the water.
The Phoenicians have an interesting
chapter. Well, the Phoenicians, certainly, but there's also a debate, you know, are the people of the Eastern Mediterranean Western or Eastern?
Right.
And I think it's fair to say they're probably as Western as they are Eastern. But, yes, the Phoenicians, Indonesians, the Chinese, the Japanese, it was ubiquitous. Probably not so much in the Americas, probably not so much in sub-Saharan Africa. Although in East Africa, there were sails, people sailing from India to East Africa and to the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea from very, very early on.
We can talk about particular moments in maritime history that are overlooked, but I'm interested in why you think that is even the case, of why we tend to overlook these very wide and large swaths of history.
Well, I think part of it is the fault of a previous generation of maritime historians who tended to be kind of fixated on the techniques and the technology and got very deeply into the jargon of the ship. And, you know, ships are very specialized things, like car engines. And if you talk to people about carburetors or square rig and gaffs and spencers and mizzens and, you know, all these different types of rigs and technical things, they kind of glaze over pretty quickly. Also, there was a real fixation, this fixation on the artifact of the ship inclined people to think in terms of the West, because for, say, the Indian Ocean region in Southeast Asia, where there's a deeply rich tradition of maritime culture, the conditions just don't favor the preservation of archaeological remains. So all over Northern Europe and in the deep waters of the Mediterranean, you have a motherload of archaeological sites to look at, and these preserve not only the ships but also the cargoes. In the Indian Ocean, you don't get that at all. And so there are literally about a handful, or, you know, five fingers worth of wrecks that you can date from before 1600 in the whole Indian Ocean.
What it's fascinating when you think about saltwater navigation, inland navigation, and what the differences are. You write about this, and because obviously there's a big difference between a river and an ocean, but as far as civilization and what comes from it and the navigation, I mean, they have that in common, but there are key differences as well.
Well, the interesting thing is that you know, people tend to think about maritime endeavor on the high seas as being somewhat seasonal. Obviously, if you have the choice of sailing between North America and Europe in the summer or the winter, you're going to take the summer. We don't tend to think of transportation on land as being seasonal because we live in the 20th and 21st centuries where everything's paved. But before the 20th century, we didn't have paved roads, and so actually, there was a lot of seasonality in transportation overland because, for instance, in the spring, you couldn't move anywhere because everything was mud. And rivers present the same sorts of problems, only worse, because particularly in North America and Northern Europe and Northern Asia, the rivers will freeze in the winter, which actually makes them easy to get across. But then they will flood in the spring, and then by the end of the summer, they frequently dry out, and you can't use them. So it's a very tricky calculus to use rivers. And rivers are also much more dangerous than overall, I think, than living on the coast. Because if you look at the news from inland, the inland United States, there are constantly reports of rivers flooding and reaching crest stage. And it's not just the big rivers like the Mississippi and the Ohio or even the Red River of the North. It's their tributaries, which, you know, really devastate communities all across the country. So that's one thing that's very important for people to keep in mind.
With that said, there is certainly the sea, there's certainly the river, but there's also the technology and the boat building and the vessels that get us, and that's a fascinating part of the story as well. The technology that has gone on over this long period of time.
Well, yeah, the technology proceeds and sort of fits and starts. So, as I said, when you go the 50,000 years or 45,000 years, whatever it is, from the settlement of Australia, and who knows what kind of boats or just floats they used to get there, it's then, 3,500 years before you start getting rowing boats, at least pictorially described. And then there's the invention of the sail, and that happens or seems to happen around 5,000, 5,500 years ago. And then it takes another several thousand years for people to come up with a rig that combines both fore and aft sails, like you see on most sloops and yachts and that sort of thing, and square rig, which were what the big sort of wind-driven ships of the 19th century that people might be familiar from museums. But it was a long time before people combined these two different ways of harnessing the wind and making a very efficient vessel. And it was that efficiency that really was part of the reason that Europeans became so deeply enmeshed in the whole sort of global exploration of the 15th and 16th centuries. And then, of course, you have another 200, 300 years after that before you get the steam engine. And then the pace of change just escalates, and you have not only the introduction of machine power, but you also have the introduction of steel and iron and then fiberglass and all sorts of strange new technologies. And then on top of that, then you get navigational equipment. And so really we are in a period of just phenomenal change at sea, just as much as on land.
The book is The Sea and Civilization. It's published by Knopf. Lincoln Payne, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Great pleasure. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.